deep sigh to mark the absence of Molly Wood. I'm so sad. 2 weeks in a row, she's decided she's got better things to do than come sit here with me on Tuesday morning at 10:15. Win some, you lose some. She's actually out doing some reporting for Marketplace Tech. So it's me again this week. Make me smart. Technology, culture, the economy, all of that good stuff. None of us, as you know, is as smart as all of us. We are going to do something today that, frankly, it freaks me out a little bit because I don't know if you remember this, and we'll talk about this later, but there was an episode like a month ago where this guy took a recording of Molly and me, or me and Molly, take your pick, and slowed it down and did something to it and made it sound like we were high. And it was crazy realistic because we were not high. So what we're going to talk about is the visual component of that, something called deep fakes. Not how to make them, because that's, if it's not yet, it will soon be a felony. I'm kidding. How to spot them, what they're about, how it happens, and then fundamentally what the danger is. And this was prompted by you guys, of course, but also by a video that cropped up the other day, like a week or two ago, whatever it was, of Bill Hader, the comedian Bill Hader, doing impressions of Tom Cruise and Seth Rogen. And as he does their voices, his face changes into Tom Cruise and Seth Rogen, and it's bananas. And we're going to play the audio and just imagine the face changing.
So he sat down next to me, and he's like, I love your work. And I go, yeah, you know, I'm friends with Judd Apatow and Seth Rogen, and they went to your house. He went, yes, yes, yes. They did come to my house. And I said, Seth Rogen was like, you know, it was amazing. He has like a, you know, a bike track in his backyard. It's phenomenal.
Right? It's crazy. His face changes as this happens, and it's Tom Cruise and Seth Rogen. It's the most bananas thing. Check out the link. We'll have it on our website, MakeMeSmart, marketplace.org. And here's the thing. It was insanely realistic. And the guy who reportedly made it, and I can't verify this. I don't know it for a fact, but he reportedly works in film and video game production. Self-taught deepfake guy who just wanted to do this to show how powerful it can be. So what we are going to do today is talk to a guy whose job it is to look at this stuff and talk about what it means. His name is Hani Farid. He's a professor at the Berkeley School of Information up at UC Berkeley, also the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. So he knows both the front of it and the back of it. Hani, thanks for taking the time.
It's great to be with you, Kai.
So look, are you as terrified about these things as I am?
I am becoming increasingly more terrified. Yeah. I would say 18 months ago, I was worried. The rate and the spread of this technology, the level of sophistication with which, as you were just saying, the average person can create deep fakes has gotten me concerned. I think what's also gotten me concerned is not just the technology itself, but its injection into a ecosystem of misinformation. So this is social media, this is interference from Russians, this is trolls, and this is, of course, the social media platforms not, frankly, doing a very good job of moderating the content on their platforms. And then adding to that, of course, is this hyper-polarized society that we seem to be living in. And to me, this may be the match that sets it all off, because now we can create this incredibly compelling content, we can distribute it to millions of people, and we have this very eager public willing to consume it. And that does give me real pause for our democracy and society.
Yeah, that last bit about the public willing to consume it, we're going to get to that in a second. But let me ask you this. First of all, talk to me about the technology. Is it advanced? Is it hard? Is it AI? What is it?
So strictly speaking, this is machine learning, and particularly deep learning, which is where the term deep fakes come from.
That's where it comes from.
Yeah. So deep learning or deep neural networks is the underlying mechanism that is used to create the content. And here's how it works. It's actually relatively straightforward. It is completely synthesized by the computer. The human has very little intervention in it. And there's really two computer systems. There's a synthesis engine and a detection engine. And the synthesis engine, as its name suggests, is in charge of creating the content. So replacing Bill Hader's face with Tom Cruise's face.
Yeah.
And the detector is responsible for saying, this looks realistic or this doesn't look realistic. And those two computer systems, each of them themselves, a deep neural network, pit themselves against each other. The synthesis keeps synthesizing. The detector says, nope, I can tell it's fake. And they keep working in tight collaboration until the synthesizer produces something that the detector says,
wow,
looks good to me.
Wow.
And so that's why the technology is so powerful, because you have two computer systems pitted against each other. The human is standing by watching this happening. And this is now why you don't need Hollywood studios or state-sponsored actors or armies of digital artists to create it, because the computer is essentially teaching itself how to create this. And this is true, by the way, not just of the face swap deepfake that you've been talking about, but also fake news stories, fake audio recordings, and other types of fake videos as well. So that underlying mechanism is at the core of all of the fake news generation that we're seeing.
I am now more terrified. Truly.
Yeah,
right? It's computers learning about computers.
No, that's exactly right. And these are, by the way, called generative adversarial networks, GANs, as they are called. And they're very, very powerful. And in part, that is why I think we are seeing this very rapid rise in the sophistication, because literally, of course, there are humans training the systems themselves. But once those get trained up, we have now democratized access to these incredibly powerful synthesis engines in the hands of the average person on the internet. And again, I think, of course, fake news is not new and fake images and video are not new. But when you democratize access to the average person on the internet who also has access to social media, I think that is a little bit of a game changer for the online ecosystem of information.
Okay, so let me take this into my professional sphere, right? What is to stop somebody from taking, and I don't know if you can do this in real time yet or not, but it almost doesn't matter. You take the president in the Rose Garden saying whatever he's going to say about, I don't know, tariffs or Afghanistan or anything, and you make him say, I'm going to tariff everything we import from China at 100%, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because
there
you have the genesis of a worldwide economic collapse.
Good, exactly. So, and in some ways, it's even worse than that, if you can believe this, because even if we figure out the video is fake, in the intervening, what, minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 10 minutes, we have global
15 seconds. You know what the algorithms are, right? Forget it.
Exactly. And now we have global stock manipulation to the tune of billions, trillions of dollars. And here's the thing: the technology to do that exists today. The technology to distribute it exists today. The fact that we haven't seen it is a minor miracle, frankly. But so, and you're getting a really important part. It's not just the fake content. It is the speed with which it makes its way around the internet. Now, also, here's another nightmare situation. 24 hours before Election Day, we have a video of a candidate saying something offensive or illegal. And now we can manipulate global elections around the world. And I don't think that these are hypothetical, by the way, because we have seen how misinformation has affected Brexit, our national election 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, Brazil, India. We've seen it lead to horrific violence in Malaysia and Sri Lanka and in the Philippines and in India as well. And so these are not abstract threats. This is not, oh, this may happen. We are seeing the early genesis of exactly these problems.
Is the government, ours or anybody's, actively trying to counter this and or regulate the technology, which is, I guess, what you'd have to do, right?
So a couple of things. We haven't talked about it yet, but another application of deepfakes is in what is being called non-consensual pornography. That is the insertion of one person's face into a pornographic video.
Right.
And that, there has been some legislation at the state level, and there is some movement at the federal level to ban, to say, look, the free rights, the free speech issues here do not outweigh the personal dangers and the personal freedoms. And there are state and both federal laws that are making their way through, very narrowly constrained to non-consensual pornography.
Right.
There, I can tell you, because I'm part of the discussions on Capitol Hill, there are also discussions on deepfakes and fake news as it pertains to Democratic elections and their use in interfering with democracy and, of course, in the fraudulent setting. So this is a tricky business, right? Because, of course, we want the guy who created the Bill Hader, Tom Cruise video to do his thing because it's very good. We want Nick Cage to be inserted into movies like The Sound of Music because it's incredibly funny.
Right.
So we have to tread very lightly here to figure out how do we regulate where we need to and not where we don't. But part of the regulation is also going to have to be reining in the YouTubes, the Twitters, and the Facebooks to make them more responsible for what's happening on their platform. So there is movement here in the Capitol Hill. I will tell you there is also movement in Brussels and in the UK as well to deal with these and in other parts of the world as well. But we are playing catch up, and we are not there yet.
So let me channel my inner Molly Wood here for a second. And since you mentioned, you know, regulating in essence or reining in somehow Twitter and Facebook and the social media platforms, that, as we all know, is a slippery slope and gets us into really tricky territory really fast. But let me then channel my inner self, and ask you this. When you're on Capitol Hill and having these discussions, you know, staff members get it, right? Because you have professionals on staff who figure this out. Do the lawmakers themselves understand what's at play?
Okay. So first of all, I think you and Molly are both correct. There are serious issues here, and we have to tread very lightly. I will say that there are some number of our representatives both here and abroad that get it. And that both their staffers and they are sort of thinking about these issues carefully and thoughtfully. And I find real reassurance in that. I will say there are others who don't get it, and that's part of my job, is to educate people. I will point out a couple of things, though, about moderating content online, is that we have been doing it for a long time. So, for example, YouTube and Facebook don't allow adult pornography on their platforms. Hmm. Perfectly protected speech, but they don't allow it. They also remove copyright infringement material. They remove all kinds of material that is actually protected speech. So we've penetrated the internet anything goes line for a long time. We moderate content online. And now we are just trying to find the line of where is this so harmful to democracy, society, and individuals, and where does it outweigh any benefits that we have? And I think I'm not minimizing that. I think we have to think very carefully about it. But we are doing this already, and we've been doing it for many years. I just think we have to do it. We have to evolve into the new technology, and we have to be more aggressive because, frankly, I don't think we've been doing a very good job of it.
You are an expert in this field, both in the impact of it and in the technology behind it. When you look at one of these things, is there a tell for you? Can you tell? Or are you like, oh, yeah, that's amazing?
Yeah. I you know, it's interesting because I was just chatting with one of my graduate students about this. You know, if you had asked me this question 6 months ago, I would have said, yeah, we can tell. There's these little artifacts that are telltale. Yeah. Those are getting harder and harder to see visually, which is, of course, why we are developing computational and mathematical techniques to automatically detect these. Because you know what the end game is going to be. The end game will eventually be that the human observer won't be able to tell even the experts. Mm-hmm. And so what we are now looking for are computational techniques that go beyond what the human visual system is capable of and can start detecting these. And we have some really promising initial results. We are building a system where we are building models to detect deep fakes, particularly of Democratic and Republican candidates for the presidency, with the hope that in particular dealing around democracy, we can fend off any type of manipulated content. Now, of course, we still have the problem we were talking about earlier, which is once the stuff is out there, it's sort of out there. But at a minimum, we can at least help debunk things when they start making the rounds.
Yeah. So let me end rather on a, I guess it's a cynical note, but it goes back to where you started our conversation, which is that people are willing and ready to fall for this. And I want to pick up on your line about defending democracy and how in some ways that's what's at stake here. We are on both sides of the political spectrum in this country so ready to jump on anything that makes the other side look bad or worse, right? What hope do you have?
Well, this is, you know, so I'm a technologist, and this now gets in a place where I'm not very comfortable, which is with people. At the end of the day, you know, we can talk about technology, we can talk about platforms, we can talk about legislation and regulation, but at the end of the day, the problem is actually us. Right. The problem is that the vitriol that the right has for the left is only outdone by the amount that vitriol that the left has for the right. Right. And this is not a way to have a society. If you look at the way people interact online, I think it is absolutely horrific. I think part of that is also a self-fulfilling prophecy because there's a feedback loop in the online communities where we start living in echo chambers and we do things online that we would never do in our personal lives and when you're sitting across the table for somebody. So I do think that fundamentally we have to rethink about how we interact with each other online because that is clearly leading to huge problems. I think the one thing that does give me hope is I saw a survey recently that said as many people are concerned about global climate change as they are about misinformation online. Hmm. I think that's a good first step. I think both are pretty bleak, by the way. But I think at least now people are aware that we have a problem, that you can't simply just read things online and believe them without taking some responsibility for where that's coming from. And so my hope is that the new generation, the ones coming up in the digital landscape, that we have to start educating them and making them better digital citizens. And hopefully we can start to sort of figure out about how to live this online and offline world, which I don't think, frankly, we're doing very well right now.
Hani Farid, at the University of California, Berkeley, the School of Information up there, also the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science on deepfakes. I don't know that I feel better, but thanks for taking the time, Hani. I appreciate it.
It's great to talk to you, Kai.
See you. Be good. So there you go. So that was an expert on deepfakes. And I don't know. Send me your thoughts. Send us your thoughts, would you? Make me smart at marketplace.org. Audio file, if you could, on your phone. It's always better that way. Let us know what you think. And check out that Bill Hader thing, too. It's kind of bananas. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right, we're back. We're back. I notice it's just me again. Just me. Molly's out running around doing that journalism thing, doing some reporting. We will pass once again on a news fix, although were Ms. Wood here, I would have several. It would be quite the knockdown drag out between us to see who would actually be more disciplined on this one. It would probably be me. All right, here you go. Your stuff that you want to say to us.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen, brother. All right, so here we go. We're going to skip over what we did last week with Neil Irwin from the New York Times on recession and what to look for there, because that's just frankly depressing. And we'll go back to our streaming episode of a couple of weeks ago. Bonnie Gouch sent us this voice memo about something she thinks we didn't touch on in that conversation about Hulu, Netflix, and all of them.
At the end of the day, we will all end up paying for services that still feed us ads. I remember when cable rolled out in the 80s, and the promise was that you pay for cable and you don't have ads like regular TV. Then the cable companies became entrenched and beefed up their revenue by selling their subscribers' eyes.
I know. Somebody's got to pay for all this stuff, and somehow subscription fees will not be enough. I'm just, you know, that's coming to us. Jeff Hoffman said the biggest cost killer is home internet.
The biggest factor for our family is the cost of our internet. Our cable provider charges us around $100 for about 150 megabytes per second internet speed if we don't bundle with the TV package, meaning cutting the cord is really not a viable option, as we'd end up spending more to piecemeal something together than just putting up with our cable provider's offering.
Yeah, so two things about Number one, did a really interesting interview on Marketplace the other day with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal about some research they had done about what you need internet speed-wise. So there's that option. You don't need as much as you think you need, even if you're streaming on like seven devices. But also, yeah, I think the whole bundling thing that became part of the cable experience is going to have to somehow become disaggregated in this land of cutting the cord and all that. All right, different topic. A couple of weeks ago, the Business Roundtable, huge, ginormous business lobbying group, announced that it was redefining the purpose of a corporation in this economy. You're going to have to take into account, you know, shareholder interests and the environment and all of that, and workers and everything, not just shareholders. Richard Steele sent us this, outlining how consumers helped actually push that change into happening.
As we enter a new decade, consumers aren't using their dollars to buy. They're using them to vote. In the next decade, firms won't be able to win simply by offering the most convenient, cheapest, or cleverly marketed products. They'll win by establishing, fostering, and communicating an identity that consumers are willing to vote for. We've entered a new age of elevated economics, and it's about time.
You know, brand is everything, right? And what you're seeing with younger consumers in this economy is that brand and an identity and values matter more than almost anything. And I think really what you could say about the Business Roundtable and this decision they made is that the handwriting was on the wall and they just decided to get on board. Now, the catch, of course, is whether companies who signed that, the 181 signatories to that declaration from the Business Roundtable, whether they're going to do anything concrete to make that worthwhile. I will tell you, we've called Jamie Dimon, the head of the Business Roundtable, and asked him if he wants to chat. Nothing yet. All right. So the Make Me Smart question, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? I am unbelievably excited about this one, and here's why. Like a year ago, through the magic that is Twitter, I discovered a dog sledder named Blair Braverman. So first of all, check her out on Twitter, Blair Braverman. She's amazing. Did the Iditarod. Awesome pictures of her dogs, the whole deal. But she's also a writer. Here is her answer to the Make Me Smart question.
Something that I thought I knew, but I didn't. I used to talk to my dogs all the time. You know, they're so good at running and they're beautiful and they're working hard. And I just wanted them to know that I was proud of them. And so we'd be running along and I'd be talking to them. Like I'd sing a song to each individual dog and just go through the whole team. And, you know, I just felt like we have such a connection. That's the right way to do things. And that's how they know to keep running and that they're doing great. And then I ran some dogs who belonged to a friend of mine. And he told me that whatever I did, I shouldn't talk to them. And so I tried it and his dogs ran really well. And some of my dogs were on that team and they did so well. And it made me realize that maybe I should try to shut up a little bit. So since then, I made a big effort not to talk when I was mushing. And I thought that that would mean that I didn't have a connection with the dogs. They weren't thinking about me. But in fact, it was kind of the opposite. They were so focused. And when I asked them to do something like turn right or go left, they did it in an instant. They weren't worried about what I wanted from them because they knew that they were doing the right thing. And when I did ask them something, they instantly responded because they weren't numb to the sound of my voice. And I felt closer with them as a result. For me, it was really just about trust. Like, I don't need to be constantly communicating with my team. I trust them and they trust me, and we all do things better. We get a lot farther if we're given a little space, and it doesn't mean that I love them any less.
Yes, exactly. Less can be more. At Blair Braverman on Twitter. Check her out. It's always entertaining. Tells good dog stories. And she writes as well, I think, for Outside Magazine. Anyway, check her out. She's really, really good. Let's see. Oh, one more plug for Blair, just because it was really interesting. And, you know, to be completely fair, she did an audio diary during the Iditarod, for all things considered. Check it out. It's actually really cool. Make Me Smart question is, what is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? Let us know. Send us your voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, the newsletter. We do a newsletter. Get you smart throughout the week. All kinds of good stuff in there. Subscribe, marketplace.org/newsletters. It'll be worth it. Click on it. Open it up. Read it. Staff gems in there. All kinds of good stuff. All right. Maybe Molly will join me next week. I don't know. We'll see. Or maybe I'll just take a day off. I don't know. Who knows? We say goodbye today to Shara Moore. She's got a new gig. She's been here for, Shara, how long have you been here? A year plus, right? Year and a half. And this was it for her. She's leaving. She's got a new gig. She's doing podcasts elsewhere. Fine. You know. All right. She waved. The senior producer is Eve Troh. Tony Wagner does digital for us. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Heathcote and Summer Dunsmore. This week's program was engineered by, yes, Daniel Ramirez. Got to check. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves, although she's off this week, so I don't know why she's in the credits. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I think she's working this week, and she's the boss, so we have to keep her in the credits. It's the rules. Okay, bye.
Bye. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.